So, Michael, you've been in Australia looking at the Asia Pacific Technical College, and we'll come to that shortly. But I wanted to ask you first about the US Seasonal Worker Program, mm-hmm. because I know that's something that you've researched. And we have recently introduced a Seasonal Worker Program in Australia, and we often compare it to the one in New Zealand, because New Zealand's so close, and to the Canadian one, because it's just very well known. But we don't really know much about the US Seasonal Worker Program, and I'd be interested in asking you about your research into that program and what that research has shown.
Right. So the thing that interests me about both of the seasonal work programs, Australia's and the US's, is that they are a form of development program. I work at the Center for Global Development, so that's the aspect of them that I'm interested in. The US's is much older. It started in 1943, bringing in Jamaican workers to replace guys who had gone off to fight in World War II. And it was conceived as a way to fill labor shortages in the US and not as any kind of development program, and absolutely nobody thinks of it that way right now. But the recent access of Haiti to the program is an interesting example of how it can be a development program. So 3 years ago, last Saturday, Haiti had this cataclysmic earthquake. The economy was wrecked even more than before. And we, at CGD, pressured the U.S. government to extend the H-2 visa program, for which Haiti was not eligible before, to Haiti. Why did we do that? Because each person who comes from a very poor country, like Haiti, to the U.S. to work on a seasonal work visa, is multiplying their earnings by something like 15 times. Mm-hmm. And people wandering around the U.S. sort of look down on these jobs. They say, oh, those are very hard working conditions. The pay doesn't seem very much. It's important to keep into perspective what conditions are like in some of the countries of origin. Like Haiti, before the earthquake, most of Haiti lived on $1 a day at U.S. prices. So getting $9.70 per hour to pick cucumbers is the opportunity of a lifetime. That money, the huge majority of that money among typical seasonal workers in the U.S. gets remitted home. It creates all kinds of opportunities for business development in the community, schooling for kids, general economic development, because most of it is spent in the country of origin on locally produced goods and services. And it's no different here in the Pacific. So David McKenzie and John Gibson, two brilliant New Zealander economists, have evaluated a couple of years ago New Zealand's seasonal work program and more recently Australia's. And they find gains of that magnitude for individuals and big positive spillovers to the households of origin, places like Tonga, Vanuatu. And what's an interesting difference between these two programs is that although both of them, by this definition, are involved in poverty reduction and development, Australia's explicitly sees itself that way, and the U.S.'s does not. Mm. So I can say that authoritatively because there are people in AusAid who work on this program. Mm. There is no one in USAID, the corresponding agency of the U.S. government, that deals with guest workers. Mm. The way I know that is because, as I mentioned, we were the agency that pressured the U.S. government to extend this seasonal work visa opportunity to Haiti. In order to take advantage of the opportunity, Haiti needed to develop, with its Ministry of Labor, recruitment mechanisms, protection mechanisms for these workers, selection mechanisms. And there are exactly zero people in the U.S. government whose job it is to help them do that. Mm. It's very much a hands-off program. If you can find workers, or some private recruiter can somehow find workers, and they show up by any means in a truck at the U.S. embassy, then we'll start dealing with them for visa processing at that moment, but nothing else. Mm. And I met yesterday a guy at AusAid whose job is to help origin country governments use this country, use this program effectively, Pacific Island governments use Australia's program effectively for development purposes, to make it most as beneficial as possible to the countries of origin, make it function smoothly, have low rates of abscondment at this end, so that the program is sustainable and politically popular on both ends. that's really a way in which I don't hesitate to say that Australia is way ahead of the US.
Mm. Yeah, one thing you said in your talk that struck a chord was that the scheme in the US is very bureaucratic, and employers often make that criticism of the Australian scheme. I know one thing they have in common is they both have a work test, so you have to demonstrate that you can't find, in your case, American workers before you hire. Now, I know you've done research into what happens when people look for American workers, and I'd be interested to hear if you could share with us the results of that.
Yes.
That so research in particular.
This is just about one group of users of that program, but it's an important group of the American guest work program. It's an important group. It is the largest single user of the U.S. guest work program, the H-2 visa. It is a network of farms in the state of North Carolina that many, many years ago decided to use this program and avoid the labor black market. And as you mentioned, in order to use the program, there are very stringent requirements. Not only do they have to spend months recruiting Americans for every single manual picking job they offer to a Mexican, but if any American shows up who is plausibly physically capable of doing the job, they must hire that American on the spot. And not just that, but if any American shows up to 50% of the way through the growing season, after you have brought in 10 Guatemalans to do the picking on your farm, you still have to hire the guy, even though you don't need him at that point. It's really a highly regulated, overbearing program. Lots of forms to fill out. If you check one box wrong, you can be set back months. Then the growing season starts and you don't have workers. Mm. They complain bitterly about this program. Mm. And they, in large part, simply don't use it. So in North Carolina, the statistics are there are something like 130 or 140,000 manual agricultural laborers in North Carolina. The vast, vast majority of them are immigrants, and something like 5% of them are coming in under the legal guest work program, and all the rest almost are black market guys. So extremely unpopular, and I believe the statistic in California is even lower, that much less than 5%, something more like 1 or 2% of the manual ag laborers are legal guest workers. So they absolutely despise this program, and one of the things they say is, look, we're forced to spend lots of money advertising these jobs, and Americans simply don't want them. They're not interested in them. Mm. And it's not because we are advertising in the wrong places. It's not because we are deliberately trying to make sure they don't find out about them. It's that, not just that once they know about them, they're not interested in taking them, but the few that actually do try it out very quickly leave. And I was able to document that phenomenon because this organization gave me individual level data on every American who had been referred to them by the state unemployment offices between 1998 and 2011. So I can say things like, for every 100 workers that were first referred to them by the state unemployment office as being unemployed Americans who are interested in doing manual picking jobs, in the typical 2 weeks that elapsed between that referral and the start of the growing season, about a quarter of them disappeared. Mm. So something like three quarters of the guys who were referred actually showed up for the first day of work. Within a month after the start of work, more than three quarters of those guys had quit. Mm. Really the problem here is not that they are being that they are not finding out about the jobs. It's that these jobs are not work that they're interested in doing. They have some better option, which might include unemployment insurance or just going without, but they're not interested in doing this extremely bitterly difficult work. The same attrition rate for Mexicans over the first month of work is something like 3%. So they, and this is why the employers want to hire Mexicans. They're simply more reliable workers. And that's nothing to, that's no pejorative statement about American workers. We're talking about extremely difficult work that I, as a person who is not lazy, have no interest in doing, because it's something that if you have any alternative to doing at all, you might not want to do. The reason the Mexicans are interested in it is because of their alternatives. At home, the typical low-skill Mexican coming to work in the U.S. in ag labor makes something like four times real what they could be making at home. So here again, Americans look at this as incredibly difficult work, and it is. But when your point of reference is something unthinkable to most Americans, suddenly it becomes the opportunity of a lifetime to work as hard as you can and make a lot of money for your family in a short period.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's a very similar situation here, in that the main competition to the seasonal workers are other migrants, either undocumented workers or backpackers coming in under a different, much more flexible visa. I'll move the conversation on, but picking up on, you know, your work on Haiti and getting Haiti included into the seasonal worker program. You know, what that, the question that raised in my mind, or the case, was New Zealand's policy of having a special window in its permanent migration scheme, point system, really, for Pacific Islanders, in particular Samoans, Tongans, the Pacific Access category. And, you know, it's a general question, but, you know, to what extent do you think, if we're looking at migration through a development lens, we should be targeting labour mobility opportunities on particular countries where we think labour mobility, you know, is particularly important, you know, as it is for the Pacific Islands? Or do you think it should be a more broad brush, non-discriminatory approach?
It's a difficult question. Certainly in trade policy, the U.S. does discriminate. So the U.S. has this thing called the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, and it is a system of trade preferences specifically designed to foster African development. And, you know, trade is typically a private firm to private firm interaction. And here is the U.S. government shaping those private interactions in ways that it believes will foster development. So that's something that apparently the U.S. at least finds acceptable, and there's certainly precedent there. I can see drawbacks to doing the same with the U.S. Guest worker program, which certainly has development benefits and certainly could be targeted to countries that need it the most. In the case of the U.S. guest worker program, the vast majority of the visas go to Mexicans right now, so to cap the number of Mexicans or restrict certain farmers from hiring Mexicans, you know, when they're in Texas and they're right at the border and you go tell them, well, you need to be hiring people from Haiti because Haiti needs it more, I can see a lot of practical difficulties arising there, maybe even some ethical complexities. But one principle I think we could at least agree on is that there shouldn't be discrimination against countries that need it a lot, and that was the case with Haiti, which is why we made such a concerted effort to get them added to the list of eligible countries. That is, that they have the pre-existing ban on their participation in this program reversed on development grounds, and it really was a tremendous step that the U.S. government took when they reversed that ban. It was one of the few times in U.S. history that an important administrative or legislative immigration policy change had happened explicitly because of development. As I mentioned, we are a little behind you guys in that Australia and New Zealand already have explicit development motives written into their immigration policy.
Yeah, I guess it's an issue for us, because if you say you open up a seasonal worker program to a big country like Indonesia, you might find all the employers go there. No doubt Indonesia needs that, and there would be poor Indonesians who benefit from it. But if the Pacific Islanders might lose, or they probably would lose, sort of market share.
From a global welfare perspective, if the Australian farmers really don't care, if it makes no difference to them, and guys in Sulawesi have not bad opportunities in Java, but guys in Vanuatu have nowhere to go, then yes, it does make sense to target the Nevans.
We've been talking about seasonal worker programs and unskilled labour, but increasingly the world's going in the direction of skilled migration. Now, from your body of research, clearly you'd be a supporter of more migration, opening up more opportunities for labour mobility. But would you want countries to focus more on skilled... Now, I'm talking now about receiving countries. Right? Countries like Australia focus more on skilled migration, as Australia's increasingly doing, or on unskilled migration opportunities, or are you really indifferent as to whether how countries structure their migration policies in terms of composition. It's just it's the number of people that's the key for you.
So there are two pet peeves I have about this this question: how much skilled versus how much unskilled. And one is for destination countries. One is for origin countries. So the conventional wisdom all around the world, sometimes seen in rhetoric, sometimes embodied in policy, like the point systems, is that skilled migrants are always better. Mm. And it's difficult for me to understand, as the descendant of exclusively unskilled immigrants. There were no PhDs in my family tree arriving in the United States. Why it is only skilled labor that is needed to build the U.S. economy. You need lawyers, and you need people taking care of the lawyers' children when they're working 80 hours a week as a lawyer. You need physicists, and you need people building the buildings that physicists work in, and different kinds of labor are complementary to each other. You need people shopping at Whole Foods, and you need people picking the vegetables that are being sold at Whole Foods, and it's kind of ludicrous to suggest that only one of these is needed or more valuable in any sense. Low-skill workers are tremendously valuable, and I would be in I would have a very difficult life without them. So on the origin country side, there is this a corresponding and mirror image stereotype that it is skilled migration that is always bad, and people are at best indifferent to low-skill migration. I mean, sure, if they can't find jobs here, then maybe they should go somewhere else, but often looking down on skilled worker migration so much that since the 1960s, there's been a cute pejorative rhyme to refer to this movement, brain drain, as a synonym for this movement. Mm. That's how most people use it, not as a potential effect of skilled worker movement, but defining skilled worker movement to be something that is bad. And here, I really want to emphasize that there are many ways to shape migration, only some of which are allowing people to move or not allowing people to move, standing with guns at the border and letting one guy in and another not another guy. For example, you can mitigate some of the effects that people are, I think, legitimately concerned about with regard to skilled worker migration by innovating in ways that people finance their education. One of the biggest concerns that people have about skilled worker migration, often discussed, is that lots of developing countries heavily subsidize tertiary education, and when those people move, the money goes with them. And to the extent that human capital externalities are highly localized, they are going to be mostly experienced at the destination. Mm. So you have a nurse trained in Malawi at a public nursing school at an average cost of $20,000 to $25,000, has been estimated, takes that subsidy with her when she goes to London, and Malawi has lost money. Getting to my pet peeve, it's the idea that the only way to fix that situation is to block her from going. And this is the kind of coercive policy that is embodied in the British National Health Service's refusal to recruit any African health workers. It's kind of a bizarre statement of policy. You know, recruitment is not hog-tying people and throwing them in ships against their will. Recruitment is going to Lilongwe and saying, so there's this job. Are you interested in it? And that's what people are being banned from doing, providing information about jobs to what to them would be considered poor people. There's another way to deal with that situation, and it's offering opportunities for people who migrate to pay for their own education, something which is beyond economically feasible. There's no problem earning US $20,000 or $25,000 working as a nurse in the UK. In a couple of years, you can earn that money and pay for your own education. What's lacking is the mechanism for that to happen. I wish that there were more thinking about policies that would shape migration, design the world as a place expecting migration to happen, rather than policies like recruitment bans, which seem to wish for a world of no migration that, if it ever did exist, certainly does not exist anymore.
So, to summarize, or attempt to summarize, you would say, this is an interesting way of putting it, I haven't heard before, so from a receiving country point of view, destination country point of view, destination countries should think more about unskilled migration, be less fixated with skilled migration. Ascending countries should be more open to the benefits of skilled migration.
Absolutely. I mean, the U.S. seasonal work program that we were discussing is a perfect example of this. The U.S. has a vast, giant need for low-skill, manual agricultural labor if it is to keep an agricultural sector. If it just wants to lose the agriculture sector, fine. If it doesn't, then it needs manual picking labor around, and it has such a poorly functioning legal mechanism for that to happen, some sort of fantasy that it doesn't need to be better or doesn't need to be bigger, that what farmers do is go around it. And I sympathize with farmers. They need workers, and they want to stay in business. And it's very difficult to use the program that exists. The difficulties in using this program are an embodiment of this idea of, you know, it's fine to have a guest worker program that is giving something like 50,000 agricultural guest work visas a year, when the demonstrated need by U.S. farmers is orders of magnitude more than that. That's not fine. A minimal recognition of the need of U.S. farmers for that labor is the kind of thing that would proceed from a balanced understanding of how much skilled labor and how much unskilled labor we need, and we're very, very far away from that kind of enlightenment.
So I like this term you've used, shaping migration, and I guess that brings us to your research topic and the reason for your visit to Australia, which has been to look at the Asia-Pacific Technical College.
Australia-Pacific Technical
College. Oh, thank you. Yes. Sorry, I should know. Yeah, no. The Australia-Pacific Technical College. And
You're making an analogy to another acronym.
I know, because we're in the College of Asia and the Pacific.
Yeah, that's it.
We're always talking about Asia and the Pacific. But yes.
I know you know what the APTC is.
No, thank you. It's the Australia-Pacific Technical College. And that is in the context of your interest of having some sort of a model that would provide skilled migrants, I think in the area of nursing, out of Africa into Europe. But I don't know if it's too early for you to say anything about the APTC, what you found, but possibly that. But in any case, just to talk about your broader interest and I guess the project that you're working on.
Yes, so it is... I'm supported by the World Bank to do this research, and they are interested in ways to foster skilled labor mobility that don't involve a fiscal drain at the origin. So let's take the example of nursing. A huge nursing shortage in the medium and long term in most rich countries that I know of. The projections that I've seen for the United States are on the order of a million. Gap between the domestic production of registered nurses and the forecast demand for registered nurses within something like 15 years. The corresponding number for Western Europe is 600,000 as projected by the European Commission. And I don't know the numbers for Australia and New Zealand, but they're correspondingly large, at least tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people. So where are those people going to come from? Mm-hmm. Well, if any component of that involves, if any component of filling that gap involves migration, then a lot of them are going to come from developing countries. Mm-hmm. And the question is not are they going to move, but under what circumstances are they going to move. If they move under current fiscal arrangements, it means that a lot of public subsidies will go with them. So how could we innovate there? How could we create mechanisms for people at the destination to participate in the financing of those educations? Could be the private sector. Imagine that the employing hospital or hospital network agrees to finance the education of a prospective nurse emigrant in return for service at the destination. Something that, a kind of educational arrangement that many developing countries already have for educating people in the exterior in return for home service. It could be a public sector arrangement in which the destination country government helps finance the education. It could be the migrants themselves, as they will also be at the destination earning quite a lot of money, and could there be a student loan kind of arrangement to help them pay? So I looked around the world for examples of this kind of innovation, and the Australia Pacific Technical College is a form of this innovation. It opened in 2007. It has four campuses all around the Pacific, Vanuatu, PNG, Samoa, and Fiji. And there are more than one campus in Fiji, so there are four countries in which there are campuses in the Pacific. They have graduated 4,000 people in what you might call semi-skilled areas car mechanics, AC repair, cooking, hairdressing, not nursing. So that's one way that this differs from the model I have in my mind. But crucially, it is an AusAid initiative. This training is funded by, heavily subsidized by AusAid. The qualifications that people get are to Australian standards. They're Australian recognized by design, and many of the teachers are flown in from Australia for this purpose to make sure that this is really high quality education. And part of the design of the program was to foster labor mobility of the graduates under circumstances that don't involve fiscal drain. A really brilliant idea. As it has turned out over the last 3 years, very few of the graduates have moved, and that's a fact whose explanation I'm interested in. I don't think that the APTC has been unsuccessful by any measure. Certainly creating 4,000 upskilled graduates scattered around the Pacific is a good thing in many dimensions, and something AusAid should be proud of, but I'm just interested in this factual question of why a program that was originally designed at least to foster some substantial labor mobility hasn't done that. Because I think a modified version of this kind of arrangement could be highly effective at in important migration corridors, making sure that skilled migration happens under better circumstances. And really it reflects this mentality that you were talking about before, just a shift in mentality of looking at migration as something that is going to happen in large measure, and what are the policies other than blocking people that we can put in place to regulate it in useful ways, ways that are useful to migrants and origins and destinations.
And that's what you'll be. That's what you are exploring in the project, is whether you can come up with a similar kind of project to APTC, learning from the lessons of that, in context of Africa, North Africa, is it?
So one possible place to cite schools of this kind would be North Africa. A natural source of skilled and semi-skilled labor for Western Europe going forward, in that there already have been substantial migration flows. There are communities at the destination. The education systems in North Africa at many levels are quite good already. I would want to see some a few features it's clear would need to be different. I would like to explore the possibility of private sector participation, maybe more of a student loan kind of arrangement, or maybe more of a participation by the employer in the training, rather than just being grants to cover everybody's training, for various reasons, one of which is it becomes more fiscally sustainable. It makes the whole enterprise less vulnerable to budget cuts. And I think it's also important to make sure that the disciplines that are being trained in really are critical shortage occupations at the countries of destination. This, in my experience, is how to bring people to the table who are suspicious of migration. There are kinds of migration that even people who don't feel so good about mass immigration can get behind, like people to take care of their grandmothers when they're not around or extremely expensive. People start to get more pragmatic about, okay, I understand that here is a shortage area, and what can we do to foster movement of people in a way that's sure it's going to benefit them, but it's going to be great for us too. And unless you target really critical shortage occupations like nursing, you can run into political shoals. And for reasons that I'm still trying to understand, the Australia Pacific Technical College has not been involved in nursing and personal care training. That could be a fruitful area for it to explore in the future.
Well, Michael, it sounds like a very interesting and important project, and one with lots of lessons and relevance for us. So look forward to staying in touch with you on that and other things. And thank you very much for this interview.
Thank